delightfully affordable and exceptionally eclectic gifts. More information on upcoming events is at KranertCenter.com.
It's 12:40. Thanksgiving kicks off a key season for tourism in New York City. Visitors will find most of the city running as usual, but at least one key attraction, the South Street Seaport, has not yet recovered from Superstorm Sandy. Dan Tucker of member station WNYC reports.
The Seaport is a small neighborhood of 19th century red brick buildings and cobblestone streets tucked between Wall Street, City Hall, and the Brooklyn Bridge. Fulton Street is the main drag. It's a row of restaurants and stores like Ann Taylor and Abercrombie & Fitch. One of the main attractions is Pier 17, a sort of mini-mall looking out on the East River and the historic ships docked there. This time of year, the Seaport is usually packed with tourists and locals, but since Hurricane Sandy flooded the area, the pier, most of the shops, and the Seaport Museum are all closed.
Well, it used to look like, if you can imagine, Times Square. It looks similar to that during the days, and even in the evenings. Now it's fairly much a ghost town.
That's Daryl Hollingsworth, salesman at NYC Bike Rental across from the pier. Before the storm, the business would see as many as 80 customers a day. When it reopened on Veterans Day, only 10 people came in. Pazanella and Son Vintners down the block is one of the few shops that reopened quickly after the storm. Owner Marco Pazanella says he had no choice but to scramble to get up and running again. Like many merchants in the neighborhood, he relies heavily on the holidays.
Panic was a big motivator. This is our big season for a wine shop. Up to 60% of your business can be in the last 2 months of the year. So we had a real fire under our butts.
But even though he's open, there's a problem. Most of the people on the streets are workers in hazmat suits throwing moldy drywall and other debris into dumpsters. Not his typical clientele. The neighborhood feels like a giant construction site. And that's keeping people like tourist Tina Wazileski from sticking around.
Yeah, I'm very surprised because it's all boarded up, the stores, and you can't come here. This is deserted. There's nobody here.
Like so many others, she came, saw the devastation, and turned around to leave. Not good news for shop owners like Marco Pazanella.
The real challenges remain having a business in a neighborhood that has no people in it, to have the corner store with nobody on the corner.
Corporate business makes up a big portion of his sales, especially during the holiday season. But many of the corporations on nearby Water Street were also flooded out. Doggy daycare owner Amanda Byron Zink says those big businesses are critical.
If they don't come back, it's a ripple effect. If they don't rebuild, we don't have a fighting chance.
Her shop lost its electrical system in the storm and could be without power for 3 to 6 months. She's opened up in a smaller temporary space nearby, and her regulars continue to be regulars. It's the other customers, the window shoppers visiting the pier, or the casual passers-by that are notably absent since the storm.
They would find us and have a coffee over at Jack's and come into my little shop and get their dogs groomed. Or if they didn't have a dog, they would just buy a treat for their dog back in Germany.
Some businesses lost so much, they won't be reopening. But for the others already rebuilding, some good news this week. The local business improvement district has set aside $1 million in cash grants to help flooded small businesses. For NPR News, I'm Dan Tucker.
Railroads might no longer be thought of as cutting-edge technology, but at one time they were, and a historian credits them with helping shape Illinois. Scott Stonzer explains.
That historian is Simon Cordry. He chairs Western Illinois University's Department of History. He says much of Illinois had not yet been settled when rails began crisscrossing the state in the mid-1800s.
Illinois was essentially a wilderness. It was the frontier. When the Illinois Central Railroad sent out surveyors to map out where their line was going to go in 1851 and 1852, there are numerous examples of these surveyors being attacked by wolves. This really was the frontier.
People now tend to think of railroads as sort of antiquated and something very outdated. What did people, you know, think of railroads? What were they like in the popular imagination?
People in the 19th century saw the railroad in the same way that we would have seen the space program, the moonshot program in particular, in the 1960s, and the same way that we look at the internet today. It's the technology of the future.
One of the contrasts between some of those technologies and this is some of the characters in these stories aren't the most scrupulous people, and maybe could you take us through some examples of that sort of Wild West aspect of it.
A prime example of what I think we could call cowboy capitalism, with the idea that it's out of control, is Henry Dwight Jr. Henry Dwight Jr. was a New York banker who was asked by the president of the Alton and Sangamon Railroad, a man by the name of Godfrey. Benjamin Godfrey said to Henry Dwight Jr., can you help me raise money? And Henry Dwight Jr. recognized that here was, to be blunt, a mark. And so he convinced the Alton and Sangamon to turn over everything to him to enable him to pillage and plunder the railroad for his own ends. And he did so, I mean, by any standards, he did so magnificently. Henry Dwight Jr. had his own appointees on the board of directors, and that enabled him to raise money to repay personal loans. He used company collateral for his own use. He would pocket insurance payouts that were supposed to go to the victims of train wrecks. He would do all sorts of nefarious things in order to benefit himself and his closest friends. And there are lots of examples of that kind of, frankly, completely unscrupulous and totally immoral and borderline illegal by the standards of the time activities. But when you look closely enough, you could argue that many of the better known railroad entrepreneurs also, like the best professional athletes, pushed themselves close to the edge of the law to find out what they could get away with. So I think that Henry Dwight Jr. is an extreme example, but certainly not the only example. The Illinois Central was trying to build into Chicago, and in order to do so, it had to cross the existing tracks of an Indiana railroad, the Indiana Northern. The Indiana Northern didn't want the Illinois Central to do that. And so the Illinois Central Railroad simply went ahead on a cloudy, moonless night. The Illinois Central kidnapped the guards who the Indiana Northern had set up, and they just slapped down a rail. They crossed the other railroad and made their way into Chicago. And the consequence was, of course, deadly, because the two companies ignored each other. And in 1853, two trains smashed into each other and 18 people were killed and 40 or so injured.
Does it strike you that a lot of the issues that come up when you look at this sort of time period are not things that we've completely gone past or figured out? Is that, am I off base in that, or does that sort of ring a bell?
Context is everything, and certainly there are differences between the actions of a Henry Dwight Jr. in ripping off completely the Alton and Sangamon Railroad. But yeah, there are definitely echoes and reflections of those acts, events, and issues in what happens today. And it's also true today that railroads are still relevant. We tend to think of the railroads as somehow only passenger railroads. But if you look at the seven major railroads in the United States today, all seven of them are very profitable. They are very busy. They're all expanding capacity without all of those containers rattling from the West Coast and the East Coast and, frankly, from New Orleans to the rest of the country. We would be severely materially depleted.
So let's say, you know, the railroad stopped working. Would we notice pretty quickly?
We would notice immediately, absolutely. One of the other commodities that railroads carry is oil. And so, for example, oil that's being produced in the United States, much of it travels by pipeline, but there's still a significant share that travels by railroad. So we would notice at the gas pump, I imagine within a matter of weeks, were the railroads to stop running.
Simon Cordry chairs the Department of History at Western Illinois University. He says unlike our current rail system, the state and federal governments did not have the power to regulate commerce or safety laws during the rail industry's early days. He says it was only thanks to court cases launched in Illinois that those rules were eventually upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Scott Stuntz.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 21st of November, 2012. It's the birthday of the man who helped spark the Enlightenment in France. He wrote under the name Voltaire. He was born in Paris, 1694, as François-Marie Arouet. Voltaire wrote so much in his lifetime, his collected works are still being assembled and edited. But we know him for his single short novel, Candide, about a young man who follows the philosophy of Dr. Pangloss, that no matter what misfortunes befall us, this is the best of all possible worlds. He grew up at a time when Louis XIV was persecuting Protestants. There was little freedom of speech or religion in France. Voltaire was one of the first writers to challenge the restrictions, was sent into exile, thrown into prison in the Bastille. He was there for 11 months, and his imprisonment only made him famous. And when he got out of prison, he started using the name Voltaire. Voltaire, who said, "Let us read and let us dance, two amusements that will never do any harm to the world." It's the birthday of jazz saxophonist Coleman Hawkins, born St. Joseph, Missouri, 1904, whose recording of Body and Soul was considered one of the great improvisations in the history of jazz. It's the birthday of Marilyn French, Brooklyn, New York, 1929, wrote her first book on James Joyce, and then switched her focus to women's history and feminism. She was a college English professor. She was nearly 50 years old when she published her novel, The Women's Room, a book that sold more than 20 million copies, considered one of the most influential novels of the second wave feminist movement. And many years later, published a four-volume work on women's history, From Eve to Dawn. It was on this day in 1877, Thomas Edison announced that he'd invented a new device called the phonograph for recording and playing back sound. He recorded himself reciting the poem Mary Had a Little Lamb and played it for people, and people who saw the first demonstrations of the phonograph found it rather spooky and ghostly. People were uneasy about the phonograph. Bram Stoker included the phonograph as a plot device in his novel Dracula. And to make people feel more comfortable with the idea of playing back sound, the Columbia Phonograph Company commissioned John Philip Sousa's U.S. Marine Band to record marches, patriotic music, and they became the first successful musical recordings to be sold. Here's a poem for today by Ursula K. Le Guin, Every Land, with an epigram from Black Elk, The Holy Land is Everywhere. Watch where the branches of the willows bend, see where the waters of the rivers tend, graves in the rock, cradles in the sand, every land is the Holy Land. Here was the battle to the bitter end, here's where the enemy killed the friend, blood on the rock, tears on the sand. Every land